Good morning, world. Welcome to Tragedy and Hope with myself and my guest, Richard Grove. And today we're going to be talking about the fact that the article I talked about yesterday on the show, Privacy is Dead and Never Coming Back, which was announced at the Davos conference, seems to be the truth of it. And Richard's got quite the information on it after talking to a former NSA whistleblower, William Binney. Good morning, Richard. Did I say his name right? Does he pronounce it Binney?
Good morning, Maria. And yes, you pronounced it correctly. It is William Binney.
Okay. Well, you know, he's one of the unsung heroes that you don't hear too much about.
Well, that's why I thought it'd be an appropriate use of my time, because anytime you do a film project like that, there's a couple weeks of planning, and then there's a couple weeks of, you know, watching all the other interviews and finding the best questions to ask or questions that hadn't been asked. There's the conducting of the interview, and then there's the post-production. On that particular project, I happened to underestimate the time it would take for post-production, so the output took a little bit longer to get out of the project. But the end result, I think, is spectacular, because while we were on set, Bill elucidated quite clearly and cogently and succinctly the demise of the American state of privacy and our rights, and he juxtaposed it to, here's what he was doing during the Cold War, and here's what they were trying to do as far as surveillance. And that's fine, because that's foreign intelligence. But when that apparatus is taken and pointed at the citizens who are paying for the apparatus, then he compared it to a totalitarian government, a Stasi, which is the East Germany secret police, or a Soviet type of state. And so that means the loss of the rights of the individual, and that the state has the monopoly on force and authority over everybody, and that individuals, you know, don't have any rights. So it's the antithesis of what the founding fathers fought for in 1776.
Absolutely. And yet so few people have any idea what's been going on, even though we've been covering it for years. But when people say we're entering a police state, I tell them we're in a police state. It's not in the future.
Well, the process they use is, if you want to be technical, it's a Fabian socialist tactic called incrementalism, generally, but in this specific case, it's Fabian socialism, which is changing over the culture of a target country generation by generation, and doing it so slowly and so continuously that it seems like it's just all one thing and that it's not changing. And so really, you can only draw these comparisons fairly by comparing, you know, America over decades or over the last century or two centuries, and seeing, you know, in the 1700s and 1800s, where was the concern of most average individuals? It was around self-reliance, and that gave them self-confidence, and that gave them self-esteem. So because of hard work and doing things for yourself and being self-reliant, all these other good fruits came of that. And a competing empire, for instance, like the British Empire, has the tenacity and the experience to say, well, let's just sit back and be patient, because we can achieve our aims over a longer period of time when people don't really notice that their culture is being changed back to the exact thing that we fought against in 1776.
Well, because you spent so much time with William, can you explain a little bit, you know, what he went through, who he is, what he did?
Well, I sure can. William Binney was a 36-year veteran of the National Security Agency. He's now a free individual who's out there espousing his views. He no longer works for the National Security Agency. He resigned in October of 2001. His team built a surveillance system called ThinThread. And ThinThread was supposed to be used on foreign targets. Well, the NSA, in possession of that technology, bootlegged it. They rebranded it. They called it Stellar Wind, and they pointed it at a new target, which was the American citizen. So hundreds of millions of people have been having their private data violated for over a decade at this point, systematically, and this was planned and put into action prior to 9/11. That's important, because it fulfills an agenda of a group of people who were pre-existing to 9/11 already trying to do this. So when 9/11 comes along, however you want to see that event, at whatever layer of historical knowledge you have on that event, it's a triggering event that is used as the excuse to fully and openly implement that system. And they even tried to go so far as the Total Information Awareness Program, that William mentions during the interview was run by, it was a general, Poindexter. And so that was out in the open. If you look it up on Google, if you just go to images, total information awareness, it's a Pentagon, it's a Defense Department operation that very clearly has like a all-seeing eye showing all over the earth. Like it has dominance and power over everyone on the planet. So these designs were in motion prior to 9/11, and even though Bill doesn't espouse the physical history on all those machinations, he sees the corrupt nature of, you know, instead of trying to solve problems, trying to grow budgets and try to build an empire out of total surveillance, which, you know, he describes in various ways throughout that interview.
Absolutely. Well, isn't it something? I guess that was the part of the trifecta of 9/11. It wasn't just the Patriot Act. It was right after that that they really pushed it down our throats, 100%. I mean, you and I have talked about 9/11 so many times. I mean, it just seems like 9/11 became convenient even for this to roll out.
You know, when you look into who benefited from those events, let's start with who got penalized, who got fired for all of those things that went wrong and all the things that were supposed to be protected with all those trillions of dollars invested in our defense. Nobody got fired. And then building from there, you know, when you look at, again, who benefits? A lot of contractors, there's been $1 trillion expended from taxpayer dollars into the so-called security or, you know, intelligence community. But really what they've built up with that $1 trillion is mass surveillance aimed at individuals in our own country, which is not only against the Constitution, but it's irrational. It's irrational. There is no need to expend so many resources spying on ourselves because I don't think we're a threat to ourselves.
Exactly. Well, I'm sure you've heard me say it many times. 9/11 happened and we all got convicted.
Well, that's evident not only now in America, you know, over a decade later with the loss of privacy and so many of our other constitutionally endowed rights. I mean, the rights that we have as a human being anywhere on the planet that are enshrined in the Constitution. But that loss of freedom has also been rolled out around the world. It's now affecting people not only in English-speaking countries, but in plenty of countries where English-speaking people are seeking to have domination over them. And again, this is not an American agenda. The American agenda that we see right now where we have bases around the world and, you know, we've been occupying all these different bases and nations for decades. We still have troops in Japan and Korea and, you know, all these places we fought past wars. And we still have two serious, you know, conflicts going on. There's still conflict in Iraq and there's still conflict in Afghanistan. These are all prior standing British Empire agendas. If you look up the history of the, you know, the Afghan wars and the wars in Iraq and the British occupation of Iraq and Afghanistan in the past, you could see that America is just now continuing that same British policy under a new branding. It's been rebranded. And the rebranding has taken away our freedom.
Right. Well, you look at that false flag in Paris a few weeks ago, and you look at the same exact thing. You know, all of a sudden, those people are now losing their freedoms. They're going to roll out a version of the Patriot Act on them. The people in France are not too happy with it. So it's the same old problem, reaction, solution.
Well, and the evidence is that even though that information might be collected through mass surveillance, the history shows that it is not used to prevent terrorist attacks. And if you compare what happened in France a couple weeks ago with the history of something called Operation Gladio, another good thing to use the internet for, you know, use the Google for something other than, you know, getting advertised to and, you know, type that in, go to the Wikipedia page, read through it, go into the sources for that article, most importantly, and start to learn some very valid history that gives a whole new perspective. You know, you've been looking at this thing, you think you know it because you've looked at it from this side. I'm saying let's walk around it and get a three-dimensional view of it, and it looks very different than what you might think. It's just like a stage. The education that we're given, it's not even education, the schooling that we're provided with gives us the audience's view of a theater stage. And so therefore you don't really see the machinations going on behind the scenes, the counterweights and the lighting and the props and how they come up and how characters can come up from under the floor. But if you take a seat beside the stage or behind the stage or off stage somehow or above the stage, you're going to gather all these other perspectives that allow you to better understand what you're seeing performed on that media stage that we watch through common mass media.
Absolutely. It's kind of like getting a bird's eye view. Well, you know, when you look at William's story, it wasn't easy for him. It sure looked like they wanted to railroad him as soon as he started telling the truth. He went through a whole lot of stuff.
Well, and it's a good case, you know, when people see Snowden, because Snowden has a lot more publicity. Why did Snowden just flee the country? Why didn't he go through channels? Why didn't he try to go to CBS or CNN or NBC or PBS Frontline or whatever? And he had learned from other whistleblowers and saw how they had been prosecuted. So you had, you know, among the first were Thomas Drake and William Binney and a couple of others, Kirk Wiebe. And these are guys who hadn't seen any other guys blow the whistle. No one had blown the whistle at that point. So they're like, well, there's official channels that we should go through, and we should file with this, and we should go to the Congress this, and we should do this with the Justice Department. And there's these different avenues through which you can officially blow the whistle. Now, I asked some of these questions in the interview because as a whistleblower, I wanted to see if he had the same naivete as I did in taking those steps. And I think he very much did, because we both expected to see results of you're reporting these, these wrongdoings to a watchdog group that's supposed to preserve the integrity of, you know, what's going on. And instead of taking precautionary measures or investigating or any of this stuff, the watchdog group then starts to persecute you in any way they can. They'll do anything and press on any pressure point to try to make you stop. And so in Benny's case, they raided him in his home at gunpoint while he's in the shower. You know, they time these things to try to get you by surprise and really, you know, put you into a state of fear. And that's no way to live within the confines of our own country, especially as people who haven't broken any laws, but rather we're trying to take steps to preserve the laws already in place. Government employees have an oath to the Constitution. So that is, their top answering point. And when they see somebody breaking those oaths and putting other people in danger and taking advantage of people like that, I think it is the right thing to do to try to, that's a naive perspective. Also, it's the right thing to do, but that's not necessarily the right way to do it. So by demonstrating that by going through channels, you'll be, prosecuted, persecuted, they'll raid you, they'll spy on you, they'll do all these things, dirty tricks, whatever. Snowden had actually learned, hey, nothing fruitful or different's going to come from that. They're going to pull out the same hammer and try to whack you with it. So I think that's where, from the perspective that he is as he says he is, from that perspective, that seems like a logical turn of events. There's also, who is Edward Snowden and what did he do at the CIA before he went there? And, how's he, so there's a whole bunch of other questions in any of these topics that one has to ask and answer in order to be learned about it. And so in attempting to communicate it back, I also have to, offer these different layers of perspective, because I'm not drawing conclusions about anything. I'm just saying some of these layers I've looked at and some of them I have yet to look at.
Well, they say that the reason they're using all the surveillance is to catch terrorists. But obviously that isn't the reason, because they haven't caught any of them. They haven't been able to stop any of these supposed acts of terrorism. Do you ever think that maybe they want them to happen? You remember Webster Tarpley used to say Myhop or Lyhop made it happen on purpose or let it happen on purpose?
Well, I think that the difference between Myhop and Lyhop, whether they let it happen on purpose or they made it happen on purpose, is just a couple more clicks of the mouse to learn about the history of our own country. If you haven't read much history, well, it might seem like all these failures happened and, they might have let it happen on purpose. And if you include into that the longstanding agenda to bring America back under the rule of the British Empire, then you might say, oh, well, this is something that everyone in control is part of that group. And so they very easily could have created that circumstance in order to achieve its outcomes, the causalities, is Hegelian dialectic. Now, you might say, well, is there any history of the United States creating its own terrorists for the sake of creating their, upping their budgets? Well, there's the March 2000 Lone Gunman episode where they say just that they're creating false terrorism to grow their budgets and to gain power. Okay, but that's fiction. That was on TV. Is there anything in reality? There's a good book that I have that I gave away and now I'm having trouble picturing it because I gave it away. Trevor Aronson's, it has to do, I'll explain the title in a second, but the contents of the book are that in 14 out of 22 post 9/11 so-called terrorist events were their own guys that they had funded and enticed and entrapped into this. In other words, they're making up their own terror. So the title of the book is thus called The Terror Factory, Inside the FBI's Manufactured War on Terrorism. And again, it's by Trevor Aronson, who's a journalist. So I found this book to be very credible, albeit a little bit naive about some of the bigger strokes of these things. Like, he's catching on to this micro pattern and saying, hey, in all these cases where they're claiming terrorism, they're actually running these guys as assets prior to that. Okay. But he doesn't see, he doesn't know about Operation Gladio. So he couldn't see, he's like, wait a minute, this is exactly what they do in Operation Gladio, which is a US and Britain joint venture that went on for like 60 years in a couple of different forms. There was the European form of terrorism that they were paying and profiting and providing these guys with the arms to do the terrorist events for political reasons. And then there's the longstanding British alliance with the Muslim Brotherhood, which they helped to align in 1928 in order to gain control of Saudi Arabia and some of these other things. During World War II, John Loftus refers to them as the Arab Nazis because they were fighting on the side of Germany. These were guys being run by St. John Philby of British intelligence and Alan Dulles, who later became the director of the CIA, partially because he ran these assets. That, according to James Corbett and Sibel Edmonds, formulated Gladio B, where it's the same thing as Operation Gladio, where it's the United States and Britain creating false terror, but it's the of the Arab format, where they're using Arab extremists and, Islamic fundamentalism as the fulcrum point through which to transfer power. So they can create, someone like Osama bin Laden, who was provably a U.S. and British asset since 1976 or 77, so that's longstanding. And then he becomes the bad guy who conveniently attacks us on 9/11, during which we had the drills running, during which money was stolen, during which gold was stolen, during which they attacked their own infrastructure and resolved, building conflicts where they wanted to build a new building but couldn't afford to legally tear the old structure down. So it's just so many of their problems got solved by 9/11. It's hard to ever see it as let it happen on purpose unless you don't really, ask any questions or find any substantial answers from those questions.
Mm-hmm. Well, I watched the 2.5-hour interview you have with William, and I'll put a live link here to Tragedy and Hope so everybody can click through and watch it. And I have to say, you did a wonderful job with it. The set, by the way, was very impressive. I enjoyed watching it, too. But the scary stuff is towards the end, where he's basically saying that if you're a target, there's nothing you can do. There's no way of reducing your risk if they're after you. So this isn't just about whether or not you're posting on social media. He makes it pretty clear that they can pretty much attack everything you have, own, where you live, your car, your house, your email, everything.
Well, and that doesn't sound very much like freedom, does it?
Not at all. And, a lot of people think, you see all these cyber attacks and whatnot, and somebody comes out with the latest encryption. This is supposed to work to keep you private. But he made it pretty clear that there isn't any encryption they can't break through.
Well, and I continue that line of questioning. After we broke down the set and we took Bill back to his hotel and we dropped off the equipment here, Lisa and I went and met him at we picked him up to a hotel and took him across the street to a restaurant that was right across the road there. And we sat for a couple hours and we shared a meal. But I also get to ask, questions like, what do you mean when you say encryption isn't safe? And he's like, well, basically, if they're not looking to back in the 90s, they had PGP, which was pretty good encryption, and the NSA was trying to crack it, and then they stopped trying to crack it. Why would they stop trying to crack it? Because they got it. Now, they're not going to come out and tell you they got it. They're going to let everyone go on for the next decade thinking that their encryption is safe. So his point is, they either have it, or if they want it, if they find out, if you're using it and you're sending it across the internet and they can't crack it, that's like a toy to them. These are guys that like to put together puzzles and, figure that out. So you're actually sending it to them FedEx, instead of hiding across, here's a billion emails that all are not encrypted and they all have a bunch of gibberish. And one of those might be you know, something that the NSA is interested in or whatever. When you encrypt it, it's like it automatically would get processed and they would try to test their new, you know, encryption and all this stuff against it. So it's just naive to think that in living in this technotronic era here in the post 9/11 world in the 21st century, that by trying to hide, that it's not enticing them to look with more scrutiny. And so that's why he doesn't hide anything. He's like, I'll say everything out in public. And I feel very much the same way. It's like, I've only had to send an encrypted email once in the past 10 years. And that's because the other person who was trying to contact me wouldn't talk unless I encrypted the email. And that was 2006 that I did that. And ever since then, I was like, forget this. I'm not even, you know, if you're trying to hide, that's the wrong way to go about it.
Right. But the negative side of this is the fear factor out there has scared journalists, you know, the few real journalists that are out there, from doing their job or even talking to their sources. So that all adds to the ignorance in this country. Nobody really knows what's going on.
And yet, from watching the news, you would think you do know what's going on, even though they're doing less questioning and less scrutiny, less research, and less honest people are reporting, and less news is actually making it through. And it's more about, here's a political slant on a current event, is what they present you with as news, which is, you know, like blasphemous. But yeah, you got, you know, he mentions Chris Hedges, who says he can't, you know, no one will be a source anymore because they're too afraid, because you don't even have to give up your sources anymore. Like the point where they're like, they come to a journalist and they're like, we want your sources. That's few and far between. That might come up like in the Barrett Brown case or something like that. But everyone else, it's like Chris Hedges, why would they ever need to go approach him? Everyone he ever talked to is recorded in the Utah data center now and stuff like that. It's like they've got these big farms set up so that they can just refer to the last decade or whatever they would need to do. And so, you know, that brings up certain questions.
Right, but you have people, you know, and I'm pretty sure I remember Obama saying, you know, all that data is, you know, it's not legible, you know, it's all just little pieces and bits and bytes of this and that. And people buy that and think this data doesn't give them plenty of information on us. But I would assume when they're after you in particular, that's the data they're going to start looking at and reading. Because people say, oh, how could they possibly read everybody's emails and this and that?
Well, they don't have to. Think of it like this. You don't need a person. You need a person to oversee it and to review the things that get flagged and these set off the alarm or whatever. But in reality, they've got computer software that sits there with an algorithm, and everything it passes by, it analyzes and it learns from. And this is the type of software that I had worked at in 2003 at Panacea, or 2001 to 2003, I think, is when I worked there. This was a private company that was right outside. It was in Annapolis Junction, Maryland, which is, you know, like 2 miles or 5 miles from the NSA. So it's a private contractor that was developing software. I didn't know this at the time. I know this from learning history afterwards. The software at the time that I was selling was artificial intelligence software. I mentioned this all in Project Constellation, that Verizon and Google were the NSA, that they're spying on people. I just didn't happen to get that knowledge because I worked at the NSA. That's all. Bill did. That's why he's a better interview, in my opinion, than, you know, I worked from the technology side and interacting with these companies, especially the private contractors. You can see exactly what they're trying to do. And then it's like, okay, they could focus that on their own stuff. But then once social media hit, once Facebook and that sort of stuff hit, it just provides this huge, like, food source for that type of software. So they developed that software knowing the trend that they were going to then start making a place where people could voluntarily put their data out there. And that would be so much more useful for them than trying to run human intelligence where they have covert people trying to spy on you in person. You see, like Stalin during the Russian days, he had to put physical spies there. Now they're just like, get a new appliance. You're in the smart grid. You know, and the guy who runs Google, Eric Schmidt, who's also going to those Davos and Bilderberg meetings and stuff like that, he was quoted recently as saying, he's also a CFR member, he's quoted as saying that in the future, the internet doesn't exist because all these devices are just going to be connected in. You know, your thermometer will just connect to the internet and you won't need the Weather Channel because you'll have this advanced system, you know, and you don't have to go outside because it's all going to be built into the devices. So just think about that. The internet as a transient thing that might have showed up for a couple decades, but then went back underground because they built it back into things. And then you can't really use it to your own advantage. You're being used by it. And so, you know, I think we also have to keep in tune with the dual nature of technology, how every time we adopt a new technology, we're giving up something else that might have given us value in some way that we might not recognize yet.
Exactly. So you're kind of describing some of the futuristic movies we see where, you know, a guy rolls out of bed and, you know, he's got like an almost invisible, a see-through screen in front of him. It welcomes him, tells him the temperature, tells him what time to leave the house, tells him what's going on, and that's it.
Well, yes, yes. And I can say that this plan's been in motion, more importantly, for over 100 years. I recently did an episode with James Corbett for his Film, Literature, and New World Order series on the topic of Philip Drew, Administrator, which is this novel written by a real-life person named Colonel Edward Mandel House, who was the advisor who brought Woodrow Wilson in and the Federal Reserve and the IRS, got America into World War I, helped to set up the Council on Foreign Relations. Like, he's all over the place. Very interesting character. He wrote this really awful novel that's 100 pages and basically in 1911 discloses his outline to create an America that goes through a civil war, comes under the hands of a technocracy and a dictator, and the resources are controlled in a very Soviet way, basically. A totalitarian dictatorship. That was the blueprint in the model for the 20th century. And now the reason that House is creating something like that is because 10 years earlier, a British guy named Cecil Rhodes left his last will and testament, and part of his money went to create the Rhodes Scholars, which are the visible part of his legacy. And the invisible part of his legacy was used to create the Rhodes Roundtable Group. And the specific goal of that secret society was to bring America back under the power of the British Empire. So you've got his will in 1902, you've got Colonel House's novel in 1911, and then you can really read the history of the 20th century all as a connection of that. There is a connectivity there. Like, there were some people with plans, they were well-funded, and they got away with it for a long time.
Right. So we're actually, you know, I remember David Icke used to call it tiptoe totalitarianism, but I don't think it's anything close to tiptoe anymore.
Yeah, it's almost to the point where they're stomping their feet and happy to let us know that they're, you know, they've got this power to surveil. I mean, ex-NSA director General Mike Hayden said in a conference, it was at the John Hopkins Forum, and it was talking about the surveillance state and security. And about 15 minutes into this, it was a debate. The question of metadata came up, and the ex-director of the NSA very shockingly said that they use metadata to kill people. That's how they make the decisions on who to drone and who to assassinate, is from that metadata. So on one hand, publicly, they say it's not a problem. We're not looking at your content. We're just collecting the metadata, because they're saying that's all they need to make their business decisions is the metadata. They don't even need the content. Although now, with the recent innovations in storage, Bluffdale and these other places that they're, these other giant NSA storage centers that they're building, storing your content's also not a problem. And they can store the next 100 years of everyone's content. And that's just with what they're building now. So then the question, you know, where in history has content been collected on people and used against them? And what does it look like? And then you start to really see history trending and repeating in an ever louder and more technocratic fashion.
Right. Absolutely. Rich, we're going to take a short break. Hold on, everybody. Rich and I will be right back. Okay, I'm back. Welcome back to Tragedy and Hope with my guest and co-host, Richard Grove. Richard was a whistleblower many years ago, and he saw where that got him. But it certainly made you who you are today, coming out and whistleblowing, Richard. I remember that day like it was just yesterday when I got your information. My hair was standing on end. But yet, you look at most Americans, and they really do buy the bullshit that this is all making us safer. And you know, you think back to, you know, those who give up their security, you know, their freedom for security, ends up with neither.
I think it's an ever-growing trend that people, again, they don't recognize, and now they've stretched it out such that the newest, you know, the latest generations don't have the context to remember a time when cash was convenient and private and anonymous. I mean, you try to make something like Bitcoin that's going to do all these things. It's like, hey, that's what cash did. The only problem was our cash was being printed by people who don't have our best interests at heart. So I think, you know, Americans should have their own bank that makes its own money, even if individuals had their own money. And it's based on an integrity rating, something like eBay, where if this person transacts the way they said they were going to, when they said they were going to do it, then they get a good rating. And that's how we decide and make economic decisions. But even in our current system, if you don't know there's anything bogus about it, you would never be creative and start to think about, well, what would be an optimal economic system that would be fair for everybody and uncorruptible by a larger centralized management system that wants to colonize the whole planet? If you look at the countries that are, you know, fighting, you know, in any given war between English-speaking peoples and non-English-speaking peoples, most of those non-English-speaking peoples don't have a centralized bank yet. So there is an underlining financial agenda that is driving the military agenda. That, you know, above that, you have a philosophical agenda, such as that they have a divine right of kings to rule over people and that you're a subject. And so this, it's just the basic differences between freedom and slavery. I would define freedom in its apophatic or negative connotation as the absence of slavery. And our rights, you can do anything as an American that doesn't take away the rights of another human being. And that applies all over the planet. I mean, they can make it so simple where we could live in harmony and really have a higher value of life all around. But they've created an artificial scarcity, and that's how they control people. They make you think there's less than what there really is, and that fear is used for the past couple thousand years to control minds.
Right. Well, you know, just knowing that you're being spied on automatically changes people's behavior. So they don't even have to go any further than that but to let you know that they're spying on you, and people change their behavior.
Well, you could say that's not a new idea. You could go back and look at the Soviet Union, or you could go back and look at the Russian Empire during the time of Rasputin, who was collecting information and formulating dossiers on people in order to blackmail them and control them. Or you could go back even further in history. I mean, this is a repeating pattern is the point. The difference today is that they have the ability to do it to almost everyone on the planet simultaneously, have this artificial intelligence software to be able to predict people's behavior, and so that allows them to have more control. And so it's getting to a point, whereas before it was isolated pockets or, you know, different areas on the planet, different times go through this. Now it's going to be everybody all the time, forever. No freedom. And that's the difference between what's at stake now and in the American Revolution. Back then, it was just a, you know, an eastern seaboard of people who were like, do we really need a king? And now it's not going to be a question, because once they have a sort of dictatorial control over the planet, you don't think they're going to let the wisdom that leads to freedom in the form of literary tradition continue. Well, that wouldn't make sense. Would Hitler or Stalin have let that happen? No. And so when you get all your books on a Kindle, which is an interesting idea, you know, Fahrenheit 451 and burning of books, and they can just add a button on one end in a central resource, delete everybody's version or change everybody's version where you don't even know, you know, I like the tangibility of a book where I can turn pages and it's actually from that year. You know, if it's from 1802, it's from 1802. This is how they wrote back then. This is how it was printed back then. This is what the pages are like. And it lends a lot more validity than just here's the latest PDF of something or the ebook or EPUB or whatever. So I'm just saying, it's not one or the other. It's how do we use both and preserve both and use both of them to our best advantage. And I think a lot of times people are presented that it's presented to them as either or.
Right. Well, I had that conversation with a book publisher just a couple of weeks ago. And she was all proud that she's moving a lot of her books over to ebooks. And I said, well, you know, that's great, but think of the burning of the library at Alexandria and all the books that were lost to us. You know, what if we had an EMP? And then all those books that are no longer on paper form, what happens to that? You know, she was pretty astounded because she had never thought that way.
Well, and I think that when you look at a trend, because the EMP, that could happen these days from a man-made event or a solar system event. And right. It's happened in the 1800s. And so it's not that far away that something could happen in a single day and take everybody in this country back to 18 whatever.
Exactly. And then what? I mean, there might be a plus to it. I guess all their surveillance would go out the window, too.
Yeah, there could be a plus to it. Of course, there could be bright sides to it. But, you know, it's like, do we really need to do that if we know how to prevent it? You know?
I don't know if you've ever watched that series on TV called Revolution, but that was the premise of the show. I don't think it's on anymore, but there were a couple of seasons of it where these computer scientists created something that was supposed to be artificial intelligence, and it ended up blowing out all the electrical appliances and electricity on the planet, and they have to start from scratch. So it was kind of interesting because it was computer scientists that created the problem in the first place. And in a way, you know, when I was watching it, I was like, well, you know, yeah, it's a rough life, but in a lot of ways, there'd probably be a lot of blessings attached to it, too.
I think that, you know, once you recognize that things could go that way and you start slowly building up the skills to fill that gap, then you don't have to fear if it happens. You're like, well, it would definitely be a change in my daily workflow, but I'm capable mentally and physically to be able to conduct the activities that lead to my survival and, you know, being able to help my family and friends. So,
right.
You know, if you notice that and you're like, oh, I hope it doesn't do that because that's a lot of fear and unknown. Why don't you just start working on that every day? And then if it doesn't happen, you still have those skills. And if you get stuck somewhere, you can survive.
Exactly. And there's so many, still so many survivalist type books you can buy, even how to make your, everything from how to make your own candles, how to grow your own food. But one of the things that William says a couple of times in the video you'd made, he said, we've done what the terrorists couldn't do, and we've done it to ourselves.
Well, I think that you have to respect a brilliant plan like that. And now you have to question who those terrorists really are. Who changed over our system? Like, for instance, America had a policy of not having a standing army until World War I, when we got suckered and lied to, you know, round up our kids and send them overseas to fight in not our own war, right? And then in World War II, we would never bomb a civilian target until the bombing of Dresden, along with the British, where they're just carpet bombing a city and, you know, just taking on this new brutalism. I mean, World War I was somewhat still fought between men of honor, where you had people from the old system that would still engage in a respectful way until, you know, things like camouflage and hiding and all these other things. Like, they would never go out and try to hide. They'd wear a red coat and say, I'm right here. Let's, you know. So you see these tactics start to be adopted. And then after World War II, it's America would never have bases around the world, except now we have bases around the world. And so America would never use the nuclear bomb on another country until after you firebomb Dresden, then it doesn't seem like such a far stretch. So if you take, you know, and compare America and the attitude, values, behaviors, and beliefs of Americans prior to World War I, they were isolationist, meaning they didn't want to muck with other people's business and get engaged in foreign entanglements. And this is something that Washington and Jefferson and all the founding fathers had advised against. Don't get involved in Europe's affairs. You like trade with them, yes, but don't get involved with their political affairs and stay friendly with all of them. But then it became, because we're so close with Britain, you know, now when Britain goes to war with another country, we kind of have to go with them. Okay. And then it turns into brutalism in war, and then the development of weapons that totally change the face and landscape of fear for all of history living in the nuclear age. You know, and then they spread that to other countries. So now there's nuclear races. And so when you get into the machinations of how that was all done, it's very interesting. And it does paint a very clear plan of some people who find freedom very offensive, because they don't want freedom because they have the divine right to rule you. So why would they want freedom? They already have irrationality. So.
Well, talk about irrational. I mean, when you see what some of these speakers at the Davos conference are saying, you know, this one billionaire, his last name is Green, he basically said that Americans have had it too good and we need to just learn how to live with a whole lot less, which is easy for a billionaire to say. So their inequality doesn't mean anything to these people. And yesterday I had a news story, I think it was off Reader's News, where a lot of these rich people now are preparing their little sanctuaries, you know, their escapes. You know, places that they feel they'll be secure, you know, hideaways. And, you know, if history has shown us anything, there will be no place safe for them. So I think that's an illusion on their part.
Yeah, it's definitely, they foster a lot of illusions. I'd like, you know, maybe hypothetically, if there was some false alarm set and they all went to their places, you could just lock them in there. But I don't think it's that simple. but it sounds tempting as an idea.
I know. So,
if your boss has one of those places, that might be a funny practical joke. I don't know.
Well, you know, sooner or later, you know, the masses will find them, okay? I mean, that's happened in every horror movie we've ever seen, okay? You know, that saying, eat the rich. I mean, that's been around forever. I remember the movie Gangs in New York when, you know, everybody had to register for the draft except the rich who could pay $300 and get out of it. And then when the poor finally had enough, they really attacked the rich in their own homes. And there was, like, no mercy being shown. And you know what? Americans are basically extremely violent people. I think it's just genetic. So I think it'll be quite interesting, you know, to see, you know, I read that some of these super rich are building underground condos that are selling for millions of dollars and you have to pay cash in advance because they think they're going to be safe underground. I mean, crazy stuff, Rich.
Well, they've also been doing that for, I don't know, 60 years. They've been, you know, doing that sort of stuff. And it's like, you know, on one side, it's their paranoia. On one side, it's the irrationality. On the other side, it's a fear, you know, campaign against everyone else who doesn't have one. And, oh, what are you going to do? I don't know. It's just, I find it more reliable to take a step back from the emotional reaction and question the whole situation and what's going on and what can be known and what knowledge can be gained by taking a couple steps and looking over here or searching over here. I just find that a reactionary judgment mentality on my part always leaves me at a disadvantage because I haven't yet taken time to observe, identify, organize, or do any sort of informing myself on that subject before I talk about it. So, or take action. The communication can be action or verbal or written or whatever, but you know, you could see a fire and decide to put it out. That would be observation, identification. What do I got to do about it? Get some water. And then putting it out would be the communication of that action.
Well, but I'm sure there's a lot of people that are, you know, hearing this, that have heard what Williams had to say, what Snowden's had to say, et cetera, et cetera. And wondering, well, what can we do about it? You know, here we're supposed to have transparency in government. Government's supposed to work for us. We have no transparency. They won't tell us anything. Everything they do is in the dark. What can we do? You know, I listened to William say, you know, we can change it with our vote. And I kind of said, oh, how sweet and innocent that sounds. How do we change the system? You know, David would say, you know, non-participation, but I'm sure he has a cell phone, okay? And Snowden came out this week and said, you know, specifically on the iPhone, how they backdoor you and listen and track you with it. So what option do people have? Should we all be like Ma and Pa Kettle and just drop away from all technology?
I like this question because I know the answer to it. I know the answer to it because I thought when I saw a couple of Bill's earlier interviews, I thought, oh, this guy is really interesting, really well-informed, and came from a position in the infrastructure where he knows what he's talking about. What can I do about this? What can I do? Well, I can find out how to contact him and organize an interview and spend months, you know, producing that interview and then share it with people. That's what I could do.
Right.
Now, most people aren't in that situation because I've spent 10 years putting myself in that situation so I can react that way, respond that way, rather, you see, taking the time to think it out and build up the experience level to be able to do that. Now, if you're at the beginning end of it, oh, well, you can share it after watching it and you can talk and discuss with other people and you can learn from that. And then you can outgrow the status quo, which means don't live in fear because they're doing this stuff. Learn how to be active in your own life instead of being a sidelined, you know, viewer. You can be a participant and start, but you can't do that until you know the game is being played. And they're playing a game for sure. And the game is take away our freedom. So what would you want to do? You want to start taking actions that lead to valuable and substantial and meaningful experiences for other people that inspire them not only to learn about freedom and the value it has to an individual, but what it means to all of us when we all have that freedom together, and what they're trying to do to destroy it can be equalized by what we can do to preserve it. And if we can preserve freedom faster than they're trying to destroy freedom, and that just means getting more people to understand what's going on. That's why I create media. That's why you create media, because it's more, I touch more people in a meaningful way every day than I could ever do in person because of the internet.
Exactly.
So the internet's out there working for me 24/7. They can access all that content and I can still get some sleep.
Exactly. You feel good at night knowing you did what you knew how to do.
I just mean it'll work 24 hours a day, whereas I need to sleep, but you can listen to those discussions or watch those videos anytime.
Absolutely. Just like my show. You know, every time I post something controversial and get my ass slammed to me on Twitter by some of the neo-fascists out there, they'll always say, well, what are you doing about it? You know, these people don't even bother to check that I do my show or that I've been doing it for 15 years. And I'll say, I've been doing my show, educating people about it. What have you been doing? And that usually conversation.
And let me ask this question. After 10 years plus of doing this show, have you recognized that the need that drives what you do has gone away, or that it's more necessary now more than ever?
It's more necessary now than ever. That's how I feel, because, you know, people are waking up. Some people are waking up, you know. It's not, you know, hundreds of millions yet, but at least it's, you know, hundreds of thousands that I'm sure have been woken up because of the work of myself, you, and so many other people that haven't given up, you know. And it just bothers me when people say, what are you doing? And I'm like, man, these people have no idea how many hours of my life I put into this every day. Because it's that important.
It reflects certain facts about our world that we dug into this and we didn't find less. We keep finding more. I have more that I need to get out today than when I originally started, because I've learned so much more, and it's missing from the public discussion. It's missing from public awareness. It's missing from the individuals who are making decisions based on the absence of this information, when really that you should weigh your decision considering this before you sign up for the military and go indenture yourself to fighting other people's wars that aren't anywhere near what they told you they were, as far as agenda and purpose and end game and all this other stuff.
See, the results of propaganda on the general public, you know, so many Americans become like rabid patriots, you know, ready to kill anybody anywhere, you know, put out a movie about a sniper bragging about killing over, you know, 200 people, everybody's rah-rah, sis, boom, bah, let's kill the rest of them. They don't realize that they're stuck. They're stuck in the illusion, the myth, and the lies that they're getting 24/7. And they're not controlled. They think they're thinking freely, but they don't get that they're being controlled by the system.
I think we also have to take in consideration that it's not an accident that American Sniper was released at the time that it was, or that it was directed and produced by who it was directed and produced by, or that it start. None of that's an accident. It comes at a very convenient time when they want to drum up the drum beats for war, bring up the rhythm and the pace of those drum beats, because they're trying to just keep everyone so overwhelmed with new things going on. Oh, there's Ebola over here, and there's storms over here, and there's terrorists over here. And that way you can't, what are they trying to, look, it's like a magic show where they're just going over the top, trying to misdirect you and distract you. What are they trying to do? They're trying to take your freedom the whole time. Your freedom is tied to your attention. And if you give your attention unquestioningly to their topics, you're going to get robbed.
Absolutely. Well, how do you define freedom? I mean, I know you say it's you know, not slavery, but, you know, I remember you and William talking about how to define truth, physical truth, and freedom. Do we still have any freedom here?
Yes, we do. We just don't have nearly as much as we could or should. That's all. We still have a lot of freedom left, and that's why we got to use the little bit of freedom we got left right now before it's all gone. And you do that by asking substantial questions and finding substantial and meaningful answers. I asked Bill about freedom. He said, first off, you know, freedom depends on truth. There's a connection between truth and freedom. And when you're deceived, they're deceiving you to steal your freedom. When they spy on you, they're spying on you to take away your freedom to decide to go to whatever restaurant or call whatever person or do whatever you want to do, as long as it does not infringe the rights of another individual. And so really, it's a very childish game that they're playing, but they're playing it at a genius level. So once we recognize the nature of people who just, you know, can't get that some people, like, everyone has their individual rights, and you have right to property, and you don't have the right to rule me, and I don't have the right to rule you, and we live in this this nice commonwealth of self-reign where everybody is responsible for each other individually. We keep each other in check as individuals, not through using a monopoly on force. These sorts of ideas could lead to a real picture of America that I think the founding fathers, they were close to getting to that point of realizing those philosophical ideals and how to put them into practice. But being that most of them inherited or owned slaves during their life, they, you know, there is a little bit of irony attached to that whole situation. But it's also worth saying, this was a topic of my recent Peace Revolution episode 86 on common sense for the 21st century, that the original Constitution, or the original Declaration of Independence, rather, had no slavery as a clause in there, that the abolition of slavery would have come in with the beginning of this country.
Oh, Rich, I have to tell you, your film is excellent. I'm putting a live link here. Everybody, put aside 2.5 hours. Take a look at it. Of course, support Rich's work, too. This is our jobs. This isn't, we quit working real jobs because we knew how important this work is. So your support to all my co-hosts and their work is necessary, and we shouldn't even have to ask for it. There's something you can do. It's a very easy thing you can do because you guys have jobs. We don't. Rich, I know you got snow to shovel, and I want to thank you so much for joining me today. This was an excellent interview.
Well, I appreciate the compliment, Maria. I thank you for providing a platform where I could come here and speak freely for an hour uninterrupted by commercials. And I want to thank everyone listening for I'll thank you in advance for watching the interview and sharing it with friends and family that you care about.
Excellent. Thanks, Rich. I'll talk to you soon.
Have a great day.